Planning Commission meeting workshop, July 14th, 2021.
Okay, present members are Rob Price, Stephen Johnson, Renee Morgan.
David Johnson.
David Johnson, yeah. And Rick Stevens. And you are our official planner is Thomas McIntosh. And Thomas, you've got the floor.
Is there a flag in here?
No.
Okay. Thank you. So there's two things on the agenda tonight, Planning Commission. Thanks for coming tonight. The first thing that we have, and just to preface what we're doing, the functionality of the workshop is to inform future meetings that we may have on a subject in terms of the hearing for a land use action. And it's to help to alleviate some of the questions that might come up. So we go over the general rules, for example, on a subdivision. We may potentially, in the very near future, have Planning Commission hearings that are applications revolving around a three-phase subdivision in X part of the city, something like that. So what we need to do is go over some rules so you know what you're looking at with the staff report and what all of the requirements. And that really cuts down on the hearing date so we can get down to kind of the intricacies of asking the applicant some very detailed questions so that we can move forward and make a more educated deliberation in terms of a decision. So what I've done up here, and I don't know if you want to spin around, it's hard for you two folks to see this. So what I've done is I've broken the review up into three different categories. Now we do a staff report, and the staff report is going to house a lot of information. The reason for that is the ordinance requires us to throw the whole kitchen sink at it. We have to take every provision that applies and tack it on. And we take the provision, and it usually translates into a condition of approval. So for example, if you want to do a subdivision that will serve up to 16 lots, you're proposing to put a street in to serve those lots, you need to put a street in. That would be a condition. Usually the street would have specific dimensions that comes directly out of the subdivision ordinance. So just by way of example, I've broken this up into what we look at from a raw land standpoint, the design they turn in, some of the requirements that we need to see in the design, and then the actual conditions of approval that we tack on the end. So if someone were to come into your office and you were a planner and they were to say, I want to take this 4.3 acre piece and I want to break it up into two phases with 20 lots a piece, 40 lots total, then the first thing that I'm looking at is, what does the raw land look like? And that acronym, that TSP, stands for Transportation System Plan. The reason why we have to factor in the transportation system plan is because we got to know what kind of detriment your proposed subdivision is going to cause on the overall traffic pattern in the area. All right, is most of the area in terms of circulation deficient? Do we have bad streets that your new property owners and your smaller lots where they're erecting houses, they're traveling through there to get to your newly brand new installed street? So that's
what's that? Paper?
Oh yeah, sure. I'll have to grab you some here. No. I apologize, I should have thought of that.
I was expecting handouts.
Oh, and we will, yeah. Just so you know, these great big things here, he's taken it and it's down to about like that with everything in it. He's condensed everything.
Cool.
So we won't have to carry around all these books. They'll all be in one in short. And two of the projects that we're looking at of us taking on with this next, we won't get it done before January, is usable lands left in the city, and then our future plans, you know, whatever.
So The sequential way of tackling this, kind of getting back to the point here, and I want to stay out of your guys' way. You guys can switch around there if you want.
Yeah.
Over here, if it's easier. It looks a bit cumbersome on your neck. Just feel free.
Oh, it's okay.
So the sequential way of tackling this is looking at the raw land first. And first, we need to look at overall analysis. So first, we need to take a peek at the transportation system plan and look at what kind of effect the new subdivision is going to have on traffic patterns. The second thing we need to do is we need to look at the terrain, or excuse me, the drainage and the runoff. The subdivision application is going to implicate that the entire property will probably be graded out and made flat, especially if there's terrain issues. They're going to want to mitigate some of those situations. So what we have to do from a city standpoint, and what part of your responsibility on looking at these applications, is mitigating any potential impacts to neighboring property owners. Runoff can happen when you start moving dirt around. It can very well happen, and it has happened lots of times, and it's been tried, true, litigated every which way it can. And so at the development phase, it's very important for the city to look at drainage. Well, how do we do that? We don't necessarily, at the Planning Commission stage of it, if we're holding the hearing, we don't necessarily have to have some big, robust drainage analysis. We just have to have some idea on how you're going to address runoff. So what are you doing for it? Are you doing detention? Are you hooking into an existing storm system? And you know, part of that requires us understanding the intricacies on how our storm system works. There's two ways they work. Either it's piping underground in the right-of-way, or it's a ditch that collects water. They're very prevalent in rural Douglas County for open ditches, certain diameter. But in the city and urban areas where you have houses closer together, we want subgrade piping. We want detention if that's required, and we want water emptying into the existing storm system. So drainage and runoff are a huge thing, and some of us may have, I know I have a little bit of a morbid curiosity. I've done some training on this and actually watched a lot of YouTube videos on my own on how to extrapolate drainage analysis through HydroCAD. And it's fascinating to me. I'm sure that you could get a good nap in if you watch or read it. But suffice to say, go ahead.
Oh, I wouldn't say.
Suffice to say, we have to look at this, and that is a very important public requirement. Now, a seasoned developer is going to understand they need to address this. Mm-hmm. Someone that maybe hasn't done a subdivision before, or maybe they're doing a smaller partition or something, they're probably not going to be acclimated to this, and we got to remind them, look, you're doing development, you're going to probably put in a driveway, you're going to put a house in, something is going to pan out from this division that creates more impervious surface. That means the water situation there is not going to do what it did before. You're changing the patterns, and now it's got to go somewhere. It could go to your neighbor's property. How can you tell us that that's not going to happen? Well, give us an analysis from an engineer.
Is this something that we could benefit from before we made a decision by taking an on-site look at the property, and so we get it in our mind what we're actually looking at and what we're making the decision on?
Yeah, a site visit can accomplish many things, and there really isn't anything on the first part of this list that you can't get a good vision for if you visit the site. We can get a good look at what the traffic situation is in the area with the streets when you're trying to travel to the site for the proposed development. You can get a good look at the site and the drainage on where, I mean, it's very clear. It's very rare to have a completely flat property at several acres that a developer wants to cut up into lots and put streets in. I mean, that's pretty rare. What is common is to have some type of sloping, and the sloping is causing the property and the runoff to do something right now that would change once they do the development. So if you get eyes on that, you can also get eyes and figure out if some of you have eyes for a wetland. If we go there during a specific time of the year, you'll definitely see it. There's only certain plants that grow in wetlands. There's typically standing water. If you go around this time of year, there's three indicators for wetlands: standing water, vegetation, or the soil capacity. This time of year, you can't evaluate that sort of thing, so a site visit would have to be done during a very specific time of the year, March, April, to get a good idea if the property is encumbered by a wetland. I'll give you an example. Off Tokay, there's a big field when you're traveling down Tokay, just before you get to the new development to the left. Traveling, I mean, to the east in town, towards Winston Section Road. There's a big field, and they're looking to develop that. We met on the site today. Near the road, because all of it slopes down, naturally, because all of it slopes down to the south near Tokay, water collected throughout the years, and some different wetland indicators started to show up. You can't tell that right now. It's all just kind of dead. But you would be able to tell it when it's more February, March, April.
So when they're requesting approval, then, at this time of year, how do you, are you postponing then your approval
no.
of the project, or how are you?
Good question. Yeah. So what I have is what's called a DSL Wetland Mapper, which stands for the Department of State Lands. That is the state agency that oversees natural features like this. And the DSL Wetland Mapper was constructed by several geologists and biologists. And essentially what they did was they mapped out areas in the city that might have the potential to have a wetland because of their soil capacity. And there's usually like an outline on where that could be. So then if I see that something like that shows up, every development that someone proposes, I look at that. And then I go, okay, is there a potential wetland on there as dictated by DSL? If there is, I have to then tell the developer, you need to go to someone that's certified and get this delineated. Figure out if it's a wetland. If it is a wetland, where are the boundaries of the wetland? Because then you got to stay out of it.
Wasn't that piece of property on Tokay when you were mayor, mm-hmm. wasn't that one of the properties that owner did a land swap with so they
yes.
could...
Yeah, they swapped the land out into some piece out in Melrose, maybe?
Because of the wetlands.
You can do compensatory storage if you have credits. So that essentially means you can get rid of the wetland here if you create one over there.
Right.
In rural Douglas County or somewhere. So it's a very cumbersome, costly process.
It was very costly for him.
Creating a wetland. However, it's not nearly the cost to demolish one. I mean, so there's that. So it's my job in the staff report to inform you if there's wetland indicators so that then you as a planning commission can make an educated decision and questions to the applicant saying, have you gotten this delineated? Or we can make it as a condition of approval. Before any development happens, condition number one, thou shalt get it delineated, and so we know what the situation is. But it's hard to do a design if you might have a potential wetland.
Yeah.
I mean, what if some of your lots are protruding in the wetland? So we don't have a ton of these in the city, but they're there. And we're aware of it. I had to be aware of it with my time at Douglas County because there's a lot more rural Douglas County. So I pretty much know where all of them are in Winston. So if someone comes in, I got a pretty good indication. So good question on that, David. That's one thing we have to pay attention to as it relates to the raw ground. Another thing we have to pay attention to is the terrain or geohazard. If it gets too steep, and you start developing on it, what we care about is a potential slide. Especially in urban Winston, it's a problem. So a lot of people ask, well, how do you monitor that? Well, you need to give us some rise and run calculations. You need to give us a certain percentage in terms of rise and run. We can do it if you give us contours, meaning you give us what your elevation is in 5-foot increments all the way up the property, and we can calculate rise over run, and then that'll give us a percentage. If you're getting up into the 15 or 18 or 20% incline, you need to start having geohazard engineer look at this to make sure soil is stable to facilitate to your proposed development.
We've dealt with that before, haven't we?
Yep.
Okay, so another question then on that. So then moving up to Safari Estates, we approved that new subdivision, Vineyard, whatever,
mm-hmm.
last year, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So they built that one house up there now, and it's having stability issues. I know that.
Is it?
Because it sank like a number of inches, that one story. So I'm curious how that one got approved and whatnot.
Well,
if we're involved in that process, or that now is just mm-hmm. a private one, because I know they're suing the contractor, I believe.
Are they? Wow, yeah. Okay. So when looking at those, so there's a difference between a large subdivision application and just a single family dwelling.
Okay.
With a single family dwelling where you have a property that's already zoned residential, you have a lot less teeth mm-hmm. For what you can ask for. However, usually in cities that have areas that might have a propensity for slides or geohazard, there's an overlay. Winston doesn't have an overlay. In order for us to get an overlay like that, we would have to have an engineer come in and do an analysis of the entire city, which would be hundreds of thousands mm. of dollars. So, in good faith, we have to use our knowledge and experience and say, look, give us everything that you do have on this particular site. We will then make a discretionary call and say, look, you need to give us some type of geohazard report or an analysis. Where a geotechnical engineer goes up, he does soil samples, he does an analysis, and he gives us a report indicating this site is stable based on XYZ factors.
So then, too, if we okay something saying that, you know, if you do XYZ, it's going to be stable, and then later on the contractor does not follow those after we've okayed everything. If the contractor doesn't follow that, are we still on the hook for saying mm-hmm. we're not, right? Because they didn't follow
our
the conditional.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's not a in good faith kind of process, because that's why we have conditions. We have to verify that conditions have been fully met prior to final approval.
Okay.
So it's a double check kind of effort. If someone comes through all the way through Planning Commission and they get a tentative approval, it's you can do this, but under these 10 conditions. Usually, to mark off the conditions to indicate they're satisfied, staff has to feel satisfied that it's been addressed. So if we get a geotechnical report and there's recommendations, usually we're going to say you need to follow those recommendations. And then we have to get some type of follow-up report indicating that it's been done. It's the same thing in the floodplain. We need to know that the house has been constructed to meet flood-resistant material rules and elevation requirements. After it's built, we have them do a post-elevation certificate. There's always kind of a double-check measure just to make sure that they did it per the standards. Or else, they're never going to get a certificate of occupancy. They're never going to get a platting process that's finally separates the lots. We can hold them up until forever if we want to.
And the other thing is, where do I start my YouTube search?
For this?
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that you could put in. So in the last probably 4 or 5 years, I've researched everything from HydroCAD analysis to you could just put in drainage analysis.
Okay.
Or drainage calculations, something like that. Perfect. And YouTube is going to take you to a lot of different. A lot of them are mundane and boring, but it's interesting to me because the way they describe their process. And a lot of drainage analysis, they have to go to a certain source to figure out what kind of soil is on the, because some soil saturates water easier than others. So they have to bring that soil information in, and that gives them a cubic feet per second runoff rate. And they have to calculate a pre-CFS number and then a post CFS number for the development. If the post CFS number exceeds the pre, then you got to do something to mitigate that. And mitigation means detention, meaning you're doing under like ground detention pond or something like that, so that it slowly goes into the storm system. And then they have to recalculate it with the mitigation, and it's got to be below the pre amount, which it usually is. This DC one was checked out real nice.
Do we have much property in the city that would need that kind of an analysis done?
Mm-hmm. All big developments, and by big I mean if it's a subdivision or more, if it's a big commercial development, we're going to have you look at a drainage analysis because we want that assurance. We're just not going to take your word that you're mitigating runoff and you're not going to cause an issue to...
The positioning of the land, like the Vandermark property, sits on a hill and stuff. That I would think that that wouldn't need it as bad as something maybe along just outside the floodplain or something.
Well, the Vandermark property that's just behind the old pawn shop, that that has pretty significant decline towards Morgan. Which is, I want to say to the south. Am I turned around, Rex? To the north?
It'd be to the west.
To the west.
To the west, yeah.
So, okay. So that has pretty significant, and the detriment there is Morgan doesn't have any drainage utilities in place. Mm. It just
not,
goes
not
anywhere.
Until you hit, really hit Sherry.
Yeah. Once you get to Sherry, then it's a little better, but it just goes anywhere. So those guys are going to have some pretty robust retention detention in place.
Would they have to develop that on up to Sherry where there is none of the...
No, we don't have the teeth in our ordinance to make people develop off-site. That's the thing. So the maximum we can do is ask for a transportation impact analysis that shows us what the detriment is in the area, and it just tells us what where the pitfalls are. And a lot of times we know anyway. I mean, you can go out and look and say, hey, Southeast Roads is just trash. Okay, we need to replace it. And the traffic impact analysis from an engineer would tell us queuing numbers and AM and PM, you know, average daily trips, a lot of analysis that would essentially conclude that you need to replace that street and sewer system.
And usually with that comes drainage.
Oh, yeah. The storm would be incorporated in.
To the street.
And, yeah, there's... we had our council meeting tonight as a side note, and it's a new budget year, and we're identifying new deficient areas to where the city sewer and street funds will be allocated. But the nice thing about this is that we are now, I am now, in full-blown, like, active mode with updating our transportation system plan. What that accomplished, because the last one's 2003, Rex, that's back in, so that's a detriment to the city for sure. What that accomplishes is if you have an updated TSP, then that makes you eligible for grant money. So if it's updated within the last 10 years, and we are updating it, it'll be updated within the next 9 to 12 months from Kittleson and Sons. We contracted it to them. Once we have that, then I can make all kinds of arguments for grant money, and so our street funds will just, that's not the only thing that we can use.
You said we didn't have the teeth in our in the planning department to authorize or to request the fixing of putting, like on the Vandermark property, you know, extending that drainage out to Sherry Street or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because we've never tried to... tried to get that in our ordinance, or
no.
Is it just that something we can't do?
Well, it has everything to do with a principle and what's called an essential nexus. So an essential nexus is a principle in the law, and essentially it's a buzzword, but basically what it means is if someone is asking for ABC, you can't require the whole alphabet. What they're asking for, your conditions that you tack on have to go directly towards mitigating the impacts of their proposal. So when you have a project that's like a subdivision or like a commercial development, a lot of times the only thing that we can ask for is how they're orchestrating that project on site. We can't necessarily require them to improve off site. The only thing that we can do is ask for an analysis on the on what the detriment is that it's going to cause to the area in terms of traffic or those types of things.
I, you know, with that specific property, I would think, though, that if they're improving above it and it's improved down here and the middle is not, that that would be a detriment. And you would think that a major development like that, there would have to be some way for them to upgrade it or something.
We can't ask for it, technically. We can, but a savvy developer or even land use consultant would appeal it, and we would be vulnerable.
If we upgrade
the higher court.
If we upgrade the ordinance and stuff and make it a requirement for everybody, would that be legal or not?
It's, well, it wouldn't be consistent with how state laws facilitate.
Oh, okay.
So that's And it's typically not consistent with how the normal mode of development either way. If you get a seasoned developer in here, he's going to say, I'm not doing this development if you're asking me to improve things off-site. You're asking me to do X, Y, Z on the property, we will do those things, but we're not going to start looking at anything off-site. Those things that are already in the city's inventory, we need to try to tackle with city funds or grants,
okay,
improving them in a sequential manner. The other thing we can do is if there is a detriment in the area, we don't have to stop them, but we can have them sign what's called a local improvement district. And what that does is if you have a bunch of local improvement district documents signed by a faction of property owners in the area, at some point when you're going to upgrade this area, you can kick in taxes and make everyone contribute. That's usually an arrow in the quiver. And suffice it to say, every single land use action someone does, we make them sign it. Mm-hmm. It just goes along with it. If you're doing a partition, a lot of times if you're doing a boundary line adjustment, we're going to give you an irrevocable offer to participate in local improvement districts.
Yeah.
If one is created. You got to do it because you're creating one additional parcel. The amount of additional traffic isn't horrendous. It's negligent. But you're still creating more traffic on the road system over there, and there are areas that are deficient. So when we choose to address that, you're going to help. I mean, everyone's going to help.
Now, that's those. An LID is not done on a storage unit, though, right? On like a garage, or it's just on a housing unit?
Anything above an accessory structure or a single-family dwelling, the city doesn't really have the ability to ask for any of that extra stuff.
Oh, okay.
Unless they're doing the accessory structure too big and it requires a variance,
okay,
then that's a land use action that will allow us to tack conditions on and ask for something extra. And there is an essential nexus there. Why? Because you are affecting, from a additional standpoint, the road system. So in the future, you need to participate and contribute to helping improve it. I mean, that's practical.
Well, so, and if they're wanting to put in an oversized building, it just stands to reason that they could change the course of water runoff or anything, you know?
Yeah, just so it's cemented in your head, this principle, I'll give you another example. If someone's got a property and they want to split it into two parcels like this, it's one big raw piece, and let's say they front Winston section. In our subdivision ordinance, we have street classifications for every street in the city. Each classification is different. Winston section is what's called a minor collector. A minor collector is constructed to withstand a certain amount of daily trips. Now, a minor collector in the city is required to be to have a 60-foot right-of-way width. So sometimes we deal with a situation where someone wants to do this division. We look at the current right-of-way width, and it's only 50. Well, what do we do now? Well, there's a property owner over here, and there's a property owner here. They're asking to do nothing right now, but they're asking to do something, divide it up. So what we make them do, we make them give us 5 feet, which is half. That's an essential nexus because we have a deficient road in terms of right-of-way width. And in the future, we will improve it. But we can't ask for a whole 10 feet because we can't stagger roads that way. We're gonna ask for 5 feet, and then in the future we're hoping they do something, or we just do right-of-way acquisition.
So
5 feet.
So Winston Section Road, is it a city road or is it still a county road?
So there is a small portion that's a city road and it's a minor collector in that capacity, but most of it is county maintained.
Okay.
I could be wrong on that.
Is that piece of property at Brockway and Looking Glass, isn't that what he just wanted to do? Or did subdivide that piece of property?
An application of that nature may or may not come before this body, but we wouldn't be able to address it because it would constitute ex parte contact because you're in a quorum setting. So if we get an application like that, we would have to talk about it during the time of the hearing. And we're going to go over that in Robert's Rules for Public Hearing.
I think it already went through, though.
Oh, it did?
Yeah.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a few months ago.
I apologize. I don't think I did that.
No, it was one that was signed off.
Mariah
did it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So there was division along Brockway.
It was Brockway at Looking Glass. It sits right on the corner, and he subdivided one of the subdivided property. It was just approved.
Okay.
So then it would be Serengeti on the back, Brockway, Looking Glass. It sits right on that.
Oh, Danielle, Looking Glass, and Brockway.
Danielle, I'm sorry. Yeah.
So that's Mr. Lavasser.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so essentially we have all the right-of-way width we need on all three of those streets.
Oh, okay.
So that wasn't required. There is a wetland situation there, and there was an access situation that we switched to Looking Glass for safety reasons, but we didn't necessarily have to ask for that, but if we needed it, we would have asked, and he probably would have gave it to us. I mean, he's putting sidewalks in. He's being a real trooper.
Yeah, I saw that.
He built that whole house like practically on his own. Mm-hmm. He contracted out the wiring, but it's just impressive. I can't do that now. And he's kind of retirement, you know, mode, and
yeah, he's very nice guy.
Yeah, very nice guy. Good question on that. But
no, I was just saying I'm surprised because that property doesn't look that wide, but that there wasn't, but.
Yeah, it actually extends across the road a little bit. There's a little chunk across the road.
Okay, yeah, got it.
Has there anything came up since January that has made this the raw unit of land and the design and the requirements? Is there anything the state has brought up since the first of the year that's made this more strict or more stringent on us to accomplish?
No, there's only general rules as it relates to raw land at the state level. There's a lot of latitude for cities to orchestrate subdivisions how they feel it meets their vision. But from a staff standpoint, what we care about is the installation of infrastructure in a practical regard. We want it done correctly. You design it and give us a design that meets the requirements, and then we'll look at it. And if it looks good enough, we'll take an application in and we'll put it before Planning Commission. And we will fill them in on what it is, what the requirements are, and then we'll allow you folks to deliberate and come to a decision. And that's kind of the process. So that's the first thing that we look at. And then we look at the design. They're going to have to hand in a design. And I want to show you, David mentioned a pretty good one. I have a handout for you. Let's look at this one. Just tell me what you think. There's two pages, and I'll just help orchestrate. There's a phasing, phase one, two, and three process, and then there's an actual detailed one here. And I'll give this to you. Perfect amount there. So the first one is phasing plan, but the second one is the one that I usually care about the most. Why? Because there's just a whole lot of information out here that I really need to know. It's one of those situations to where when people come down, we're able to give you specific answers if you give us a specific detailed drawing that helps us answer more detailed. So what you're going to see here is Will Way. If you're holding it like this, Will Way is over here. If you tilt it like this, Will Way travels up to the north and then back to the east onto the subject property. And the reason they're orchestrating access like this is because you have a pre-existing type travelway situations.
Oh.
You have an easement that runs down, which is the extension of Serengeti. So this is one that came before Planning Commission that gained a tentative approval, that's still in a tentative approval stage. And you'll notice once you get up into the subject property, you got a lot of new proposed streets. You got a street that terminates all the way to the north end, and then you got a street that wraps around Ohana. They're really kind of channeling the Hawaiian deal there. But you got one that terminates on the eastern end, and then a cul-de-sac that runs here. So what am I looking at? Well, there's square footages in each lot. What I know is that the rule says each lot has to be at least 6,000 square feet. I'm checking if any of them are under. That's the first thing I'm looking at. Then I'm checking the right-of-way width to see if they even got it on there. If they do got it on there, does it match the right-of-way requirement that we need? Normally it's 50 feet. They've got it 45 feet riddled all over, and that's because they applied for a variance to go 5 feet less. One of the reasons why we let them apply is because they agreed to put paving in off-site. They've got a chunk here that's not on their property that they're going to have to pave.
Well, this, every time I see that we gave them a variance for their street width, I think of Plum Ridge. This isn't going to turn into a Plum Ridge if we by doing that at 45, is it?
Plum Ridge is actually a smaller street than 45, I think.
Oh yeah. We caught hell over that because people can't even park on it.
36 or 8? That's just horrendous.
It's yeah.
Terrible. No, that was a small street type. So the whole state just dropped that after they tried it for a little bit.
Oh, okay.
And the cities have the latitude to say no anyway, and Plum Ridge subdivision is a good example on not to allow streets to go too small. Mm-hmm. And what we want is something consistent as you drive through Will Way in the northwest area of Brockway. We want it consistent moving all the way up the hill. And what they proposed, they came up, and this goes directly to your point, Rob, towards making people do something off-site. Will Way is paved, and then it terminates, and then these guys are proposing all this. So essentially what you'd have is you'd be traveling down a paved street, and then gravel, and then turning, and then it'd be nice and paved again. And we can't have that. That's not consistent. So we allowed them to move forward with the variance in as much as they pave that area as well. So sometimes it's a status pro quo, okay, or quid pro quo. That's the word.
Now that guy that lives up on the hill lives over here, right?
Let's see.
Would that be...
Yeah, so what they do is they travel up here. It's up here.
Okay, so this road here goes up to his house?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It does.
Yeah. Which one?
Right here. He lives over here.
Yeah.
So
he does, yeah.
Lives,
yeah.
Go on this road and then up to his house. Now, is where this is pavement here, is there anything we can...
They're not proposing anything beyond that, so it would just terminate...
And then it would be basically gravel or dirt from there up to his place.
Yeah, the way that the code works is that the more units of land that you want to serve, the more you want to break up, the more you have to improve the street leading to it.
Okay.
So if you're improving or if you're proposing 10 lots, then the street has to be a certain width up to. But then once you get down to 4, then 3, you can start making it substandard because anything below 2 lots just requires an easement. Mm. I mean, that's the idea.
Yeah.
And then past there, if you propose 12 more lots, you're going to have to improve up to that point again. So the more units of land that you want to serve, the more you're going to have to improve the street leading to it, which is kind of the land, the rule in transportation. So this is a good example on some of the things that we're looking for. So when you see this in your packet, as part of the staff report, you're going to have a big, long-winded staff report from me. And any of you could call me at any time and say, hey, let's talk through this. I'm sleeping. And I'm happy to just talk with you and just say, hey, this is what this is, this is what this is. But with the staff report, you're going to have a design, and it's kind of up to us to say, hey, they're kind of missing the ball on X, Y, Z. Or maybe sometimes what you guys bring to the table is, does this really meet the vision or the compatibility of the area? Sometimes we get so stuck in the rules that we're just not thinking of those important factors. So that part of it has to do with phasing, number of lots, the sizing, the street circulation. Is a good east-west or north-south circulation? Is what they're proposing makes sense from these requirements? And that's why we need a design like this,
yeah,
so that we're able to tell.
That's why I mentioned earlier about a site visit. If you may not see it like this up there, but if you go up there and you look at it, you can go up there on your own, or we can go up as we can't go up as a quorum, right, before the meeting?
As long as you start the meeting, and you acknowledge the members present, then you can go up there as a quorum.
Okay.
And orchestrate.
But if you go up and you look at this beforehand, and get a picture, take this with you and get a picture of any site, not just this one, I find it a whole lot easier to understand if you can see it.
Yeah, the site visit will be a real benefit moving forward. A lot of these bigger projects, we'll just plan to do that and fold it into the project. Are there any objections with doing that sort of thing? A site visit on the property? Yeah, we'll just get approval. There are a few coming up, and we'll all need to put our heads together and just kind of meet out there, and you guys can tell me what you see, what your feelings are on it, and we can get that type of feedback from Planning Commission. It's really valuable to me, because I fold it in.
And where I'm really new at a lot of this, it helps me to go, like, with you guys who know what's going on, so I can kind of visualize and ask questions about what I'm seeing. Am I seeing the same thing that everybody else is? No.
Yeah. It'll really help resonate when you're looking at it. And if you were to see this one, it would definitely help sink in because there's major terrain issues with this one.
Yeah.
So we have a clear couple conditions dealing with geohazard because there are areas of the property that get up into 21% incline.
And then it plateaus in a couple areas too, and then it goes up again and it's different.
Yeah, so that's real important for those components. And then once we look at these two areas and we apply the provisions in the code that are applicable, then we're going to come out of the other end with conditions of approval or requirements. And it's going to deal with all of these things. So we're going to say to them, or you are, as a planning commission, you're going to deliberate and say, hey, we're good with the staff's recommendation, but you need to now go out and build that exactly like you proposed. Because that's what you propose, so that's kind of what we want to see built out. And our conditions are going to be very specific. And if you look in that file, you'll see 21 or 22 conditions in that brown file that relate to each phase. There's a condition towards put Omaha or Ohana Street in, the extension of Serengeti shall be XYZ. Vineyard Way has to be, there's very specific conditions to everything. And so there's no confusion on everything they need to do. You know, the streets, curbs, gutters, sidewalks, the stormwater detention, the utilities, the fire requirements, which is hydrants, all of that stuff has to be put in per the code.
And I see a lot of that on here, but maybe I'm missing, the fire requirements, is that something that, do we get a report from, like, the fire department itself?
What?
Or am I just, I'm not seeing something that I should be seeing?
What? No. Great question, Renee. And if you came into my office and you submitted an application for a subdivision, let's say that happened. Let's say it was this one with this design. What I'm going to do is take it in with the fee because we want to be paid, right? So we're going to take it in. And then what the code's going to require us to do is take those materials and send them around to adjacent property owners within 150 feet and public utility districts. We send that application and that request along with the design to the fire district, the water district, public works. We even send it to ODOT. We send it everywhere. And then what we do is open up a 20-day comment period. So what the water and the fire district's supposed to do is during that 20 days, they're supposed to tell me what they want. They don't always do that. So I have to reach out and say, hey, what do you want? You want hydrants, right? This is a big subdivision. And they're just kind of negligent with, I always think that's kind of whimsical, but so I reach out and I say, hey, Landon, the water, what do you want? You want water lines put in underground, right? You want 4-inch lines? Like, great. You want meters on each property. So we then take that and that helps inform the conditions. And so then what happens on the end, when you deliberate and you come to a decision, you say, we agree with staff's recommendation along with the associated 22 conditions, and you issue the tentative approval, and then I then start on condition compliance, which means you go out and build it. For example, if it deals with hydrants, put the hydrants in 200 feet away from each other or whatever it is, and then you give me a letter from the fire district indicating you put it in per their specifications. Then we mark out that condition, and it's a great way of doing it. It's called condition compliance. And they're not separating the lots with the surveyor's office and finalizing anything unless we check off every condition. Okay. And that's how it's typically done. So you're not just giving, as planning commission, you're not just giving a blind okay. We're trusting you to go out and put this stuff. There's a very robust checking system in place. Well, essentially what you're doing is you're saying, look, this meets the intent of the land. You've proposed something that's consistent and meets the rules. We agree with staff's recommendation. So we'll approve it, tentatively approve it, along with the associated conditions. So that's why at the end, we offer a sample motion that says, I, Renee, pass a motion to accept alternative one with the associated 22 conditions. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So you're not only the planner, you're basically the compliance officer too.
Yeah, I guess somewhat. I mean, when I used to do interviews up at the county, I always joke with people like, as a planner, you need to be ready to be kind of part-time engineer, part-time land use attorney. Because one day you'll be talking about subdivision requirements, the next about Oregon revised statutes on land and different stuff. So this part of it requires us to make sure and check, and that's what one of the reasons I came to Winston, because I love working with Public Works. We have a very amazing Public Works department here. The director, you couldn't ask for a better one. Him and I look at stuff together all day. All afternoon we were looking at sites at where people are going to build and do something. And we're making notes and we're making sure that everything is being done consistently per the rules. So, yeah, I guess I am kind of fall into that groove.
Yeah. A
lot of hats among others. So, so once the requirements are carried out, you kind of have what we call a perfected file, and that's what you see is the ending solution to a lot of these subdivisions where houses go in. Once the infrastructure is put in, the raw lots can be what we call platted, and then they're legally separated, and then you can build a house on them.
Thomas, so like on this specific piece of property there, so mentioned the levels and stuff, but the overall gist of that property is it runs down, so it all slopes down to the south,
mm-hmm.
Looking glass. So when you're looking at the raw piece of land, we've already approved this one and whatnot, and you're talking about drainage runoff, there is a wetland in there,
mm-hmm.
And I think, as I recall, they made an accommodation for that. They were going to section it off or whatnot.
It's a 20-foot easement, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then going back down to the requirements, stormwater and stuff, how do you know that that's not going to change the water tables by the building, or change the wetland on that raw land, how they build, the way it slopes and whatnot going down?
Well, the main way that we know is by their engineer extrapolating that to us through empirical data. That's the only thing we can hang our hat on is empirical data, and it comes through the drainage analysis. And for example, for this application, we had to have them look at a lot of stuff up front before we would really even take an application, and that's because of the sloping issue. And we got to a point to where we can accept an application and we can look at putting it to planning commission for them to tentatively approve, but we had to address a condition towards detention as well. Because they orchestrated a way that even though there's going to be raw land to the south and to the west that might be mitigated, a lot of the soil in the area is pretty good for farmer foresting still,
mm-hmm.
So it saturates pretty nicely. A development like that is still going to cause a pretty big detriment if you don't mitigate it. So part of this plan has detention areas that were incorporated.
Isn't there
So if you look at lot 73, you'll see DET. Mm-hmm. They have a very significant couple of areas where they would be offering detention and capturing that water prior to it going down the hill.
Mm.
And what I saw was a lot more than that. The design didn't bear it out, but Dave Thomas, the engineer, not associated with the Wendy's friend, he gave me calculations and I made sure they checked out. So we're not asking you to trust staff, but those types of things are out there. If Planning Commission, for the pleasure of your viewing, wants to see those, we will produce them. I mean, it's that simple.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I don't think I remember, that's what I was going to say, I don't think I remembered seeing or talking about that. I know we talked about the wetlands issue, but so I was just curious. Okay.
Yeah.
I know that existing seasonal drainage course and stuff that's down there by the, what is that, the school, Rockway and stuff, it's never really filled up, so it drains quite well.
Go ahead.
Well, I was trying to remember, I think, do you remember somewhere up in here, I don't remember what building it was, we ran into a rock shelf just under the dirt. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you remember where it was from the top of here? Was it farther east?
I think it was farther
it's
east.
More near the quarry, I think.
Because it ran across the top, and that's where we ran into steep slope overlay issue up there.
Yeah.
Because of that rock shelf.
Yeah,
I was trying to remember where it was according to the end of this. So it's got to be over here then.
One of the problems with this property, as well as the property to the west and the east, or excuse me, the south, is that the steep slope overlay was removed in 2005 and 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When they did the plan amendment zone change to change it from AO to RM. I don't know if you were in there at the time, but they annexed it into the city. They did a faction of applications, just a whole slew of them. They annexed it, they changed the plan amendment designation and the zone, and they did the large lot removal for the overlay. But the interesting thing is, years and years went by, and it was still showing up on the title.
Well,
these guys came into my office and they were like, it has to stay at 50 feet. It says that on the title.
Well, we didn't actually, there was a lawsuit that could have, because this was one of the first things, you were mayor, and I'd only been on the planning commission a couple years, but that steep slope overlay, there was a major lawsuit pending if we would have allowed I don't even remember the name of the developer up there, remember?
Yeah, but that was more to the...
But it would have affected...
The east, that's the Williams property.
Yes.
Williams,
yes.
Yeah.
It was
but it affected everything up there because it went across.
Yeah.
There
ridge
was
up
wetlands
there.
Down at the bottom of it.
Yeah.
There was wetlands, and then there was a steep slope that basically the fire department said, we can't even get up there.
Yeah.
Funny you should say that. He just called today and sent me an email on... wanted to know about the development in the area. Wants to actually change that property back to AO. I gave him the requirements, and he was kind of put off that there's been a lot of subdivisions happening in the area, but no one's been calling him. And I said, I can't speak to that. We review them. I mean, you want to turn in one, anyways, it's kind of whimsical. You should mention that. There was a view shed issue there, too.
Yes.
Very prevalent.
Because of Wildlife Safari was part of it. And... we basically went like that and said, have fun, guys, because...
Yeah, the safari didn't... They said we...
Yeah, because if we'd have done anything, we'd have been prone to a lawsuit. So we kind of didn't do anything and left it at that. And we knew that somewhere down the line, it's going to bite somebody.
Williams stuff would come back.
Yeah,
well, from a planning commission standpoint, if I was in your seat... I would say your position is always acting in good faith.
Yeah.
So the way that the process works is that if you have a neighboring property that just doesn't like something, they're throwing a lot of flack on you as planning commission, and you need to be more responsible as community leaders and those types of things. I'm not scoffing at that because that's language we get. What as planning commission body definitely needs to keep in mind is the process on what they would need to do. You are not individually being sued. That's not happening.
Yeah.
What's happening is that we go through the normal process and they would appeal the application. The application would be appealed to City Council, the higher court above that. There would then be a hearing at City Council, and it would be weighed against the merits of the code, and they would either affirm your decision or they would remand it back to Planning Commission with assignments of error. If they affirmed, the objection could then appeal again, but then it would go to the Land Use Board of Appeals. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the appellants would have to hire an attorney. Their attorney would not be able to be present before the three-panel LUBA panel. So that's what happens. You're not individually being sued because you're always acting in good faith.
Yeah. Been down that road a couple times, huh, Rex?
Yeah, there's a few cases.
I learned the hard way when I first started on the Planning Commission.
the planning commission got hit with all of that at once.
Yeah, you kind of get inundated in those types of things. And there are definitely property owners out there that will threaten litigation. But just keeping in mind that you act as a body, you know, we kind of close ranks and stand together as one. You're making an educated a discretionary call based on the merits of the code. We have an application before us. Does it meet the code requirements or does it not? Does it meet the intent or compatibility? If you make those decisions and leave the bias and the political inhibitions out, then you're never going to go wrong, even if it's appealed to LUBA. Mm-hmm. It's not a problem. They're not going to say anything. They're going to give you assignments of error saying the applicant didn't address this well enough or this one. Or they're going to come down and say, this is denied based on these factors. And at that point, the applicant would have to apply again, a whole new application.
There's nothing above LUBA to apply to?
No.
Nothing.
Yeah.
LUBA is the last stop, and they're the highest court as it relates to land use processes. Okay. And you want them, when it comes down to it, you want them to make the decision because they are long, long time land use attorneys and they really know their stuff. I mean, they do. So at that point, there's an attorney fee and all kinds of other things that the appellant would have to hire an attorney, because you, as a property owner or an applicant, you can't argue before LUBA. It has to be your attorney. It has to be. So it's a very robust process. But at any rate, if that makes you feel better, you're operating as a unit and you're operating in good faith. So you're never sued individually for anything as it relates to your decisions.
And what's the primary reason that they appeal? Is it because they request a variance? Is that the issue? Or is it that...
The reasons they can appeal are usually what we have to care about.
Okay.
So if someone offers objections, I have to then take it in and say, is this within the planning scope?
Okay.
And we're talking drainage, odor, noise, mm-hmm. traffic, things we have to address because they cause a detriment. If it's something like, we don't want that in our neighborhood, or that's going to decrease property values, I'm going to just kind of acknowledge that in a sensible manner in the Planning Commission hearing. But I'm going to advise you as Planning Commission and as a staff member that this is outside of the scope of the planning review. It's not something that we're required to address, although we are sensitive of it. I'll give you an example. The Tokay subdivision that we did, we had a room full of city council. Remember this one? Most of the people, their concerns were crime and the speed that people were going down. Remember this?
Oh,
the
yeah.
speed that people were going down Tokay. And however sensitive we are that is a criminal police matter. What we're looking at is a subject application that's on a 4-acre piece and it's a 23-lot subdivision. So is there going to be a runoff issue? Are they proposing it to where it conforms with the rules? Those are things we have to look at. If they are not, if it's going to cause a detriment and it's clear and the opposers are proving that, then you have teeth in your appeal. You do. And it happens more in rural Douglas County when they're trying to do something on farmland. There's more of a precedent for that. But in an urban area where the intent is to develop, it's tougher. Usually the developer is in a good position.
Another good example was that RV park over off of Abraham. The neighbors hit us with everything under the sun, you know. And
that got appealed to council, but it didn't go any further than council.
Right.
It was upheld.
I don't know how many times, two or three times it came back to us mm-hmm. for objections, you know, and then we finally had to send it to council, you know, because they had to make the final decision on it.
And that didn't even go through.
Yeah. Well, it didn't go through.
That's the way it goes, you know.
It didn't go through because we didn't give them the 180-day stay they wanted. We only gave them 90, I think, or 60.
60.
Because we didn't want people living there. It was supposed to be an RV resort.
That was a tough one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know, I think it was maybe a few months I came in after. And I don't know who facilitated the file, but that's what the detriment can cause as staff if we can't advise you properly.
Yeah.
There's an ORS statute, 197, that illustrates if you're in an approved RV or mobile home park, you can't regulate the length of stay. So essentially what we did for a while is violate state law. It's no big deal. It happens in smaller cities, and nobody did anything wrong. But we can regulate the length of stay if it's in the floodplain. We can do that, and it's 180 days.
And this one was in the floodplain.
Yeah. Right. So they were doing a 30-day, and then it was kind of a 60-day, and then that condition kind of got rolled off.
Yeah.
Eventually. But it's my job to advise you, and that's why I spend so much time trying to dig up the information so you have everything. I throw the whole kitchen sink at you so you can make an educated decision. So let's switch gears. Before I stay on a tangent, I'm going to get out of the way of Renee here. So, Robert's Rules for Public Hearings. Now, what I mean by that is when someone submits an application for an administrative file to where you folks have to be triggered to meet and make a decision on it, we have to hold a public hearing. A public hearing has Oregon administrative rules on how to conduct it. If you don't conduct it per what the rules stipulate, that is a precedent for an appeal, and they will win. If there's a procedural defect, if we did not do something correctly, and it does go to LUBA, they will throw it out on a procedural defect and won't even look at the context. So it's imperative that, I'm not trying to scare you, because usually I'm there as a safeguard to kind of say, procedural, I'll speak up, Rob will tell you I'm no problem with being vocal, because it's about protecting you guys, yeah. Making sure that you're facilitating that the way it should. So there's a sequential way that you conduct the hearing. So the first thing you need to know before you actually get into the hearing is, like, whatever the application is, don't talk about it when you're in a quorum. Do not. If you're all together right now and we start talking about an upcoming application, biases can creep in because you talked about it together. You can make your mind up, and it's been tried, true, litigated every which way. You just can't. It's what's called ex parte contact. If you did talk about an application here on the date of a hearing, each of you would have to recuse yourself, and we wouldn't be able to make or at least express ex parte contact. And then the applicant, or the opposer, if they're well rehearsed, they could then ask that you recuse yourself.
And you might not have enough to make the decision.
Right.
And then what would happen? Who would make the decision?
If there's an issue with them, this has happened a few times in the U.S. It happened back in North Carolina. It would then immediately go to the higher court. A hearing would have to be done by city council. Mm. So planning commission is essentially dismissed. So we just don't want to be in that position.
Would
so,
it go to the county planners to make the final decision?
No.
It would go to city council.
City council. Okay.
They would have to conduct the public hearing, and you wouldn't hear the end of that.
Yeah. See, that's what I keep trying to... I think that anybody that sits on city council should have to go through the planning, at least a year in the planning department so they know some of this stuff.
There is one exception. If you're doing a legislative amendment, what I mean by that is we have our ordinance, right?
Yeah.
We have our comp plan and we have our ordinance. It says very specifically how to orchestrate permits, land use actions. There's language in there on how to do everything. If you want to change that language and change how we do something, for example, you want to change the height requirement for a structure in a residential area from 30 feet to 35, you have to go through a state process called a legislative amendment process. It's legislative writing, it's in place, you have to amend it, and it's a very robust process. There's no such thing as ex parte contact when we're doing that, and it requires a hearing, and it requires it to go to city council as well, a two-body approval mechanism that's always been required for changing the text.
So on a legislative amendment thing, we can talk to each other and ask questions and...
It's everybody's ordinance.
Yeah.
It's
everybody in the city's ordinance.
Okay, okay.
Anybody can talk about it. We encourage people to come out. We can talk to council about it. There's no risk of ex parte. But anything below that, I'm talking land partitions, subdivisions, variances, conditional use permits, quasi-judicial plan amendment and zone change, everything below that has to come before this body. Don't talk about it in the corner. We'll be safe.
Yeah.
And you'll be protected. You can talk about it. There's two of you that can talk about it, but if one of you then calls up another person, then all of a sudden you have an informal quorum because you've got three people. I mean, how many? Do we have six total in our
room? We have seven actual members, so we have four as a quorum.
Yeah, I just wouldn't. You don't want to hear about it before the hearing anyway. Even if it may seem exciting, you want to come with a fresh mind on it, and you want to come in without any chance of bias, and you want to look at the material. You're going to get my material 7 days prior to the hearing. Mm-hmm. You're going to get a notice 20 days prior to the hearing. If it's a legislative amendment, you'll get it 35 days prior to the hearing. So you got ample time.
Yeah.
The materials will be there, and you'll have plenty of time to develop your own questions and potential concerns with it.
That's another reason, too, that if we don't do a site visit the day of the hearing, make sure that if you go with yourself or one other person and don't go as a quorum and write everything down, and if nothing else, call Thomas and say, look, I just did a site visit. Can you answer these questions?
So we can contact you if we have major questions one-on-one.
Staff is at your disposal, and what I will say is in a lot of cities that I've dealt with, they're so busy that they might get back to you maybe a day before the hearing. I will answer. Use me as a resource. I want to do that. And as a matter of fact, I was going to ask everyone tonight, instead of calling you or doing something like that, I'm fine with sending out a group text even the day before or something like that if you all respond to that. Just let me know, and I have a city phone, and I'll shoot it out to you. Mm-hmm. And we'll correlate that way. You can shoot me a text. You can call me. I will answer. On my phone, it's better if you call on my cell, because if I'm out in the field, I will answer a planning commission member because I'm at your disposal. You know, I want to be here for you as a resource. You can ask any city council member here. They all call me. I think several of them call me on the same subject, and then they don't know from each other that they're so it's just kind of one of those things. So once we get a good idea of this and just kind of store that away in our long-term memory, can you see this?
Mm-hmm.
So Robert's Rules for Public Hearing, what you're going to start with is just by opening the meeting. Opening the meeting, there's going to be things before it, old business, new business, and then actually a component within the meeting is going to be the public hearing. So opening a public meeting is not opening a public hearing. Opening the public meeting is we're calling this meeting to order. We need to do roll call. We need to have it vocally on the record who's in attendance in order to acknowledge we have a quorum. Because we do the audio recording and we don't do any visual recording at this point.
Yeah.
So at that point, once we get to the public hearing, I have a script usually for, and some of this is very onerous on Rob, on the Planning Commission chair. If we need to nominate a co-chair or a vice chair, so we need ideas on who would maybe step into that. And if the chair is gone, then they would have to conduct the public hearing. With my help, I'll be there. Just ask, you know, Rob and I have that rapport, and, you know, we'll all have that rapport. So once you open the public hearing, the first thing we need to think about is qualifying Planning Commission. And by qualify, I mean you didn't do this. There are very targeted questions. Do you have a financial gain in this application? There's very targeted questions. Qualifying Planning Commission means that you are here not violating any of the rules, meaning you don't have a hidden financial stake in this, you haven't talked to the applicant, you definitely haven't talked to the applicant about the application, because if they talk to you, they can sway your opinion. You may think, I'm going to stay unbiased, but it's happened a lot. So the rule for ex parte is, if we're dealing with an application in a public hearing setting, then you can't talk to the applicant about the application. Qualifying Planning Commission has, that's an intricate part of that. Once all the Planning Commission is qualified and we're all good, everyone's qualified, then you'll qualify parties. What I mean by that is you might have people in the audience that act as an individual party. It could be a specific person, you know, whomever. And what you do is for them to be qualified as a party, they have to come up and they have to state their name and address, and they have to state the reason why they want to be qualified as a party. What qualifying parties do for people out there is it allows them to speak later in the hearing. It allows them to give testimony for or against the application. Once we qualify parties, at this point, this is where the planning commission chair usually has to stop people and say, look, we don't want to hear your issues with it yet. We're just qualifying you as a party. Mm-hmm. That'll come later during the testimony portion. And then it's up to me. Then I get a staff report, and you got to listen to me talk. The bigger the project, the more I got to talk. And I've got to go through the staff report, and I got to offer my recommendation to you. And this is all the work that I did, all the challenging hours and the site visit and all that stuff, and correlating with the applicant and the property owners. And I'm putting all that down on paper. And this, more importantly, this is essentially all the ordinance requirements that apply to this project put on paper for you, and all the things we have to address. And there's a recommendation there. Once I give the staff report, then the applicant always has the ability first to come up and give testimony. This is what my application's for. This is why I'm doing it. This is why I feel like you should approve it. So they're going to give a testimony, and it's always going to be in favor of their application. And then you go to other. So then we deal with this part. People give testimony that are in favor, qualified parties. Hey, you want to come up? Okay, state your name and address again for the record. You're a qualified party. Now, they give whatever they want to say. We like this because of X, Y, Z. Usually you're not going to get a lot of those, because if people like it, they typically don't feel the need to come. They'll just assume that it's going to be approved. Here's what you'll see more of. After this happens, then the planning commission chair opens it up for testimony for those who are opposed. This is a very important part, because this is where procedural defects creep in. This is where people want to argue. There's a very sequential order to this, and we are not required to navigate from it. It's not necessary really in any way. Even if they seem mad, if they seem frustrated, our job is to conduct a public hearing as the rules dictate. And what the rules dictate is that we let the applicant give testimony. We let those in favor, then those opposed, then we let the applicant come up again and offer a rebuttal to those oppositions.
Can I insert something here real quick? Mm-hmm. When we listen to those people that are opposed to this, I've sat with most of you long enough to know that it hasn't ever happened. But don't take it personal. Don't let it affect your decision, because you just go by what the rules are. Because sometimes you'll think, well, that's a good thing. Maybe I'll change my mind on it or something. Just listen to what they have to say and don't let it affect your decision, because you got to go by what's on paper, whether you're against it or not.
It's not a discretionary call. It's not an opinionated call. It is a call based on, does it meet the criteria?
Yeah.
That's what matters.
Mostly opposed is going to be on feelings.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely on feelings. And without a doubt, here's what happens in this process, and this is where procedural defects happen a lot. Applicant's rebuttal happens, and they are rebutting what these opposers said. And then once the applicant gets done offering a rebuttal, these guys are going to say, aren't you going to let us respond to what he said? We're not required to do that. You can. Yeah. You can, as a planning commission, you can offer that if you see fit. Yeah. It's a planning commission chair and commission as a whole, this question. And what you can do, Rob, is you can say, we can vote on allowing more testimony into the record. You can do that too, or you can make the discretionary call. It's up to you. If you feel like these guys are now going to get up and offer more relevant material, they probably won't.
Yeah.
They probably
just
said,
going to want to argue.
Yep.
Yeah. But we don't want to be facilitators.
And I think you told me.
That's right.
I think you told me when I started, if you're ever sitting in the chair, don't let them get their feelings out. Just let them make a decision, because once you get the feelings out, you've lost control.
This is the big area where, like I said, where procedural defects happen. It happens there. It happened with the BNS CEP. There's just a lot of arguing back and forth. Then after that happens, what then happens is the hearing gets closed. After the hearing is closed, any communication and conversation between planning commission is confined to just commission and staff, you and me. That's it.
Yeah.
What happens is there's after the hearing gets closed, there's a lot of communication between the applicant and commission still, which constitutes a procedural defect. It's okay that you're wondering, just don't close the public hearing if you want to ask more questions to the applicant or property owners or really anybody in the audience. You can ask questions to me anytime. There's an exemption for city staff
to commission. We are your liaison, we're your supporter. So we have open rein to talk to you on, and we have to kind of help navigate you through the process too. So we have open rein regardless if it's open or closed. But if you feel like you're going to continue to ask questions and just vet everything out to the applicant, don't close the public hearing. Make sure not to do that, because when you do, after you do close it, you get a savvy opposer. They're going to say, this is all a procedural defect after this, and we can oppose it. And go ahead.
So on this one, so going back to this, so we did a full, the only thing that we didn't have was the opposed. So I have a question on that. On the individuals that are opposed to that, is that anyone in the city limits? Is it only the 150 feet that affects? How?
Good question.
That? Okay.
Yeah, so if you want to give opposition in any regard, if there's a public hearing being done on it, you have to be a qualified party,
yeah,
and then you have to speak, and then you can do an appeal. If you did not come to the hearing or participate and become a qualified party, there's no precedent for you to appeal.
But on the qualified parties, so if they come as a qualified party and they ask to speak, is there any requirement, though, that they live in the city of Winston?
No, no.
Nothing, so they can...
So it's up to you who you qualify as a party. It's okay. It's typical standard for Planning Commission to qualify anybody as a party. You could live in California and maybe want to move up,
okay,
and catch wind of this, and you decide to come and participate. So mostly what we see happen is nobody gets turned away, but you can vet that out and you can choose not to qualify someone as a party. You do have that ability. I wouldn't recommend it because it opens you up and kind of makes you vulnerable. You want to give people a platform to speak.
Okay.
Because you don't risk anything if you don't. Because if they speak and it's not relevant, then we don't have to address it anyway. If they speak and it is relevant, then it's something that we probably should address. I mean, that
if we deny somebody party status, can that come back on us? Can they take that to the city council and then to LUBA or not?
That's just the thing. You have to have a good reason to deny someone party status, and it usually relates to either they're related to one of you and it's an extension of ex parte,
okay,
or it's something that would require you to have to not hear from them.
Okay.
And
okay,
give them that status. You know, it's just very rare cases that I've ever heard of that happening.
Okay.
Okay, so just making sure I understand this. Once we close the hearing, we can no longer discuss with the applicant or those in opposition, but we can still talk to
me.
You.
You can talk to me, yes, and there's a script.
Right.
And you'll see that in the script. Once we close the public hearing, no further communication can be discussed between the applicant, and I think that's near the end. You still have one. That's very impressive.
I got them all. I got boxes of material.
Yeah, it should be. So it should be the next page.
Next page.
Yeah. So that's staff report. Closed. Once the hearing is closed, there can be no further testimony received without opening the hearing. So, is there a motion to close the public hearing? So final question. So there's a final question. Does the Planning Commission or staff have any questions of the applicant or other parties? And then it moves on to close the hearing type stage. So further testimony is any communication, any kind of discussion, anything like that.
And that's after we've discussed it. So if a question comes up that you want to ask the applicant, that's when you say, okay, I'd like to ask another question of the applicant before we close the hearing.
Yeah, and any response that the applicant gives is tangible material and counts as testimony as towards their application. I mean, it does.
Yeah.
That's how it's seen in
yeah,
the process. So that is the process. We want to take extra care, and it doesn't mean we need to be mean. That does not mean we need to be crass with how we want to facilitate and allow people to speak. We want to give them opportunity. So if you feel in your heart of hearts that there's more tangible and relevant information that's going to come in, you could keep it open. And you could, after a rebuttal, you could get more testimony from the opposition, people who have party status.
There might be a situation that near the end, when you're about to close the hearing, someone all of a sudden walks in. You can feel like you can give them party status. It doesn't have to be in the slot that we've allotted, and then you can allow them, but then you'd have to allow the applicant to offer a rebuttal to that then.
Yeah. Okay, so I have a question then on that. So let's say this, you know, where they're building the pizza place here, that red building mm-hmm. is for sale next to it there. So if we get a lot of interest in something, let's say we want to put a strip club there, so it gets, you know, the whole public involved, can you set time limits on this and state that up front before the application,
that's
applicant testimony?
Yeah, that's in the Oregon Revised Statute, and I'm glad you brought it up. So the law dictates a three-minute time period. You can limit testimony to 3 minutes apiece. I'll give you an example. The off-road highway vehicle park in the county that was being proposed by Douglas County. It was out Colonial Road, out the Looking Glass area. And we had, this was when I was with Douglas County Planning, we had like 183 people show up to council chambers at the courthouse. We didn't have enough seats. We had to do an overflow area. So we're limiting. They can't even follow all the way through this because they're spending the whole 2 or 3 hours initially to allow testimony to come in. There are snags that you can run in that typically they face at the county. If you are facing a complicated decision, you do not have to make the decision the same night. You don't. Here, there are some do's and don'ts. So here's a big do. If you hear the word continuance, if you hear the word continuance that's being requested from an opposition, someone in favor, the applicant, the ORS statutes require that you have to grant one if a continuance is requested. A continuance means the decision is not made tonight, but it's made at a future planning commission meeting.
And that's from either side? If either side requests a continuance, we have to grant it?
Yep.
Okay.
If a continuance is requested, ORS 197.493, you have to grant it for a time certain, no less than 7 days. 7 full days, not business days.
Right.
So typically what we do is you do a continuance and keep the record open. What I mean by keep the record open means new relevant material can be submitted while keeping. Yeah.
Okay. If a continuance is granted, does that automatically cut the meeting right then and there?
No. You finish the meeting, but a continuance means that the meeting ends once all the relevant material and everyone wants to speak comes in.
Okay.
But it's just usually this happens because during this stage, those in favor and the applicant produce materials that the opposition is not ready for. So in most cases, the opposition wants time to address those types of materials, whatever the evidence is in the record. They want to be able to construct. This is by all means, land use law. You're becoming land use attorneys right now, absolutely. Because Robert's Rule for Public Meetings, there's a lot of intricacies. And a continuance is a very rare case in the city of Winston, because most often cases, you'll have someone show up that doesn't even know they have the option. So there's that part of it. But if you get someone savvy enough, and they can't address what they need to, or the opposition has came up with some stuff that just blew the applicant out of the water, and they're like, I don't know where to go. I need time to address this. So they'll use that keyword continuance, and that triggers your requirement to, and I would clarify this if you didn't know in the hearing, I'd say, Mr. Planning Commission Chair and Planning Commission, we have to offer a continuance because it's required in Robert's Rules for Public Hearing. So we would set the next Planning Commission hearing for probably at least 2 weeks out to give 7 days for the applicant and an additional 7 days for the applicant to be able to review whatever was turned in, or vice versa, and then they have an additional 7 days to put in new evidence to address that.
Yeah, I think we've only, in 17 years, I think we've only done one continuance, and that was just because we had so much testimony. It wasn't
we had...
You could do it for that too, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We had so many applicants and so many opposed that, you know, that we just had to continue it or we'd have been there till 5 o'clock in the morning.
And you naturally keep the record open for that. Right. Most cases when you're doing a continuance, you can close the record, but in cases like that, it's because Planning Commission is just kind of, they want time to think about their decision. That no new relevant material is going to come in, and we know that. But you just need time yourself. And so a Planning Commission can request a continuance during the appeal period after your decision. A city councilman can request a hearing within 14 days. There's lots of options that public individuals have.
If we're having trouble making a decision after this whole process, and we get together, we have trying to make this decision, we can say, can we have another 7 days to go back through the material and talk about it again and make our decision?
It gets a little into the weeds for Planning Commission themselves to ask for a second continuance. There would have to be a good reason. And if the applicant and the property owner and the applicant are ready to go, then they would probably want a pretty good reason on record on why things are being so stalled. I haven't heard of it happening. But this is so rare, but in the case that it does come up, you have to know just kind of what your options are and what we would need to do. So immediately if someone was asking for a continuance, then I would be working with Planning Commission up there to, after we've went through this cycle, before closing this portion of the hearing, or we wouldn't be closing the hearing, you wouldn't use that language.
Right.
You would say, we're continuing the hearing until a time certain of X date at X o'clock, to where we will, and we will keep the record open. You would have to use that sort of language.
Do we have to give a date at that time, or?
Yeah,
okay.
It has to be communicated to the entire.
Yeah. And then I would think you'd have to be really careful of the whole ex parte thing.
Oh yeah.
That you're not discussing any of that else. Yeah.
So in the discussion of all this, after the applicant's rebuttal to the opposition, whatever they had to say, that is, as I remember from the other one meeting we went to, that is when we voted. The applicant's rebuttal and the closing, is that correct?
You wouldn't vote until after the closing of the hearing.
Until after the meeting.
After the closing, so he's going to have language. Once the hearing is closed, there can be no further testimony received without reopening the hearing. At that point, he would close the public hearing with the gavel, and then you would deliberate. Keeping in mind that you're deliberating and talking amongst yourselves, it has to be heard by the audience. It has to go on the record, what you're talking about, what you're saying. And then with do's and don'ts, and that's a good question, thank you for that. What a lot of people get stumped with is passing a motion. So here's what we need to know, and this is the last thing, and then we'll close with that. There has to be a motion passed by someone other than the chair. Sorry, Mr. Chair, you cannot pass the initial motion. You never can. You don't have that pleasure. These guys do. The initial motion has to be passed by someone who is not conducting the public hearing. It has to be seconded. And then you call for the question. When I say call for the question, I mean that's when you discuss it, any last questions between you, talk about it a little more, vet it out. Sometimes people will call for a motion to get seconded just so they can get put into this mode of a intense discussion. And then, after you do that, then you all have to vote, and it has to be vocally clear who's voting aye and who's voting nay, and that's put into the record. And then after that, we would do findings indicating how each of you voted, and if it was unanimous, or if there's a dissenting vote, or whatever it might be. So you have a procedural defect if you don't accomplish all of these components. So if you were just to pass a motion and a second, but then there was no vote and no directive on saying all in favor, any opposed, then we don't have a complete vote and it's a procedural defect. And it's happened, it's easy to do it.
Recusing oneself, at what stage do you need to recuse yourself? Is it early?
Here.
At the qualifying part, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely you'll want to get yourself out early if you feel like there's some kind of confliction, and that's the safe thing to do.
Now, once they say they're disqualified, they can't even sit on the panel, right?
You go and sit in the audience.
Yeah.
At that point, if the reason you're recusing is because you're an adjacent property or you're affected in some way, you cannot participate in the hearing. Mm-hmm. You cannot offer testimony. You cannot. That's been tried, true, litigated as well.
So what happens if the person that disqualifies himself, if that drops us below a quorum, then do we just have to stop the meeting?
Yeah, you would have to then, we would have to postpone the meeting if there's no quorum. You need a quorum to make a decision.
Right.
So, and tend to do a motion.
Well, that brings up another question, because you said the quorum is a minimum of four.
Four.
We have seven members.
Yeah.
That's problematic, because what if there's a 2-2 split? You should always have an odd number, right?
Well, the quorum has to be, it's not necessarily four, it always has to be a majority of the group. So if you have five, it has to be three. If you have seven, it has to be four. If you have nine, do you know what I mean? So.
And six is four. Yeah.
So then if you have four that show up,
right,
you have a quorum that's there. If it's an even split, then there's a problem. Then we'd have to postpone it and potentially have another vote when we have more members who can break that.
So then would you have to ask for a continuance at that point?
We would have to... Either a continuance, or if we're deep into the hearing, then it would be a continuance for the purpose of a non-quorum or a stalemate or whatever it is. Sometimes it falls under the postponement rules, but not when you're that far into the meeting. It would definitely be a continuance. So the vote's very important. I know I've thrown a lot of stuff at you guys, but if all of these things are in place, if we kind of like get them in our long-term memory, then it typically just gets down to talking about the application. The rest is just kind of second nature. Then we can dig in and we can say, all right, well, what is the code? It does require you to be a little bit like planners, because you got to know a little bit. But you can ask me, because I'm there. You can say, hey, what is the rule on this? And I can usually tell you. It's not because I'm smart, it's because I have to inundate myself in that stuff.
When do we get our new files?
So, the zoning code has been put into the municipal code in the city. So, it is a chapter in the municipal code, which is like any other city I've worked in. So, what we're doing is getting you new municipal codes that have everything in the city. We're making you copies. That is a steep endeavor, but we are hard at work at it.
Did we thin it down by doing that?
No, it's the municipal code. It's a big guy.
And you have to carry the whole thing, or can you just break out your section?
You can break out the land use element if you want to do that. And what's important for us, it's not going to be in there, or the zoning code, is the subdivision ordinance and the comprehensive plan.
Yeah.
And I know all that's a lot of, you can get a good nap in, and it's a lot of monotonous reading, but there's a lot of good stuff in there on how we do the decision making. Especially when you get into comp plan and all that data on housing units and, you know, but that's good stuff. I mean, the more we talk about that, the more I'll just throw the relevant data at you. Like, look, this is what, like, we need for this. Do you know what I mean? So
in the next year, what are we going to be updating? The available lands inventory?
Mm-hmm. The buildable lands inventory, the housing needs analysis, which is what we need in order to expand an urban growth boundary. That needs to be updated. So if we're going to entertain any way of looking at our UGB, then we need to update those.
Okay.
If we don't get a standard technical grant from DLCD, then I will do it. It'll just be, a big endeavor.
Yeah.
And we have to pull census data in Portland State University population growth center numbers. That's the usual medium for figuring that stuff out. It'll be onerous on me, but that's why I came on. And
so we're gonna push the revision of the comp plan aside for now.
No, we're doing that.
Okay.
I can work in concert.
Okay.
I can multitask. That's fine. We want to do
Sorry, guys, I tried. I know we want to. We have to do that. It's not a matter of want.
That's not the only thing we have to do. A legislative amendment means there's we can change anything in the code by striking out language we don't like and adding new stuff in. So it's your vision. So let's talk. Let's figure out what you feel like can improve in the city, and let's do that. What you want. That's Planning Commission.
Yeah. So take a section and read it and go through, and if you see something you don't like, see how we can change it. I mean, that's our job.
Little blue notes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Questions? This was beneficial, I hope.
Yes.
And a lot of this stuff, if you don't understand it, call Thomas. Rex has a good knowledge of this stuff, and I can help, you know. Rex probably knows this stuff a lot better than I do.
I don't know. I kind of got behind on it.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. And you gotta keep up to date with everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to email you guys my, or if you want to write it down, you can too.
Your cell number?
Yeah, yeah, so it's 541. I'll wait for everyone. It's 541-391-1494. So that's 541.
Is this your personal cell or your?
391-1494. It's doubling as both.
Doubling as both.
Because
okay.
I have nothing to hide, Mr. Chairman. If they subpoena my records, I'm a pretty boring vanilla guy. So that's just kind of is what it is. But except for me yelling at my kids, that's, you know, I have two.
Yeah, that's
boys,
part of parenthood.
They're just kind of both kind of at that age. But yeah, you can reach me. You could text. You can call. I will answer. If for some reason I'm inundated in something, I will always call you right back. So I want the correlation, definitely from all of you. If it's something you don't feel is relevant, still call, because, you know, we can discuss it, and it'll probably lead into something that, you know, it is most times. If it's in the evening, you can still text or something. I may not always answer, but if you feel like you're going to forget it tomorrow, email or text or even call. And, you know, I want the collaboration. Like, I'm excited for it. So, yeah, thank you guys.
Anytime you have questions on ex parte contact, or if you feel any kind of a conflict with an issue, call Thomas.
Yeah. Don't